Thanks so much for staying with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, the horse symbolizes so many things. For me, and I bet for you as well, a power, certainly beautiful animals, so power, beauty, devotion. And there's so much more to these incredible creatures than what I ever expected. And I found it out in a new book that's out. Just out. It's called The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companion. And the author is Wendy Williams. Wendy's a journalist. Her work has appeared in, oh my goodness, Boston Globe, New York Times, and many, many other publications. She's the author of several books, a lifelong equestrian. And Wendy, so glad to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
It's really, I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book. Right off the bat, I loved your, I would have loved to have known Whisper.
Well, everybody loves Whisper. I loved Whisper, but I didn't realize when I was that young how much I really should have loved Whisper.
Oh, my gosh. And explain who Whisper is.
Well, Whisper was the first horse that I was ever responsible for taking care of, and I was pretty much on my own, and poor Whisper had to clue me in on a lot of things, like the fact that water freezes in the winter in buckets in the stalls. So, you know, you would have thought I would know that it was Vermont, it was minus 10 degrees, but it just never occurred to me for some reason. What can I say? I was 20. So I wasn't used to the cold. In my defense, I did not grow up in Vermont. I should say that. I didn't grow up in a place where water would freeze in the wintertime, so I didn't realize it. But he managed to survive me, and he managed to lead his buddy Gray, his workhorse sidekick, off on some wonderful adventures around town. And he had a pretty good life in spite of me, certainly not because of me.
Well, that water incident was great because he observed you turning on the spigot in an earlier time and remembered that.
Yes, he did. That was what was so interesting to me. When I was 20 and had to deal with the problems he created because of that, I was just irritated and hoped that he didn't break the outdoor spigot. But now that I'm a lot older, I just turned 65 a couple days ago, I've been more curious about how he actually learned things. And there's some question about whether horses learn by watching, and I would say that it's indisputably true, certainly with Whisper. Gray, not so much. Maybe he learned but didn't act on his learning, but Whisper definitely had to act on his learning with me.
How did you come to write this book? Obviously you have this long-standing interest and love of horses, and that probably contributed to it.
Well, you know, I had two streams of interest in my life. One was science, being a science journalist. I'm not a scientist. I'm a science journalist, and I like to read very geeky books and write about them. And the other stream was my lifelong interest in horses and my riding in many different ways all over the world. When I was 5, I told my mother I would write a horse book. And as I mentioned, I've just turned 65, so I figured I better get that job done.
So
now I have.
Well, it's a very engaging book. I'm telling you, I really have enjoyed reading it. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. I haven't done that yet. So you may have some questions about horses. What similarities do you see between horses and people? What do you love about horses? I'd love to hear what you have to say. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a great experience to share with horses. I've got a few experiences, some not so good, some pretty good. The 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mealer Show, and you'll also get a link there to Wendy's book as well. You know, your book starts off with an amazing discovery that I think speaks a whole lot about horse-human relationship, and that was that piece of ivory.
Yes, wasn't that exquisite? Exquisite. You know, what I wanted to do, the idea of this book was to trace the partnership of horses and humans or proto-humans over time, as much as science could do that. So when I found this particular tiny piece of sculpture, I just fell in love with it. It's somewhere around 30 to 35,000 years old. No one's quite sure precisely how old. And it's a tiny little thing, only a couple of centimeters by a couple of centimeters. It's carved out of mammoth ivory, of all things, and it's just an exquisite piece of work. It's the oldest known piece of horse art in the world, and one of the oldest known pieces of art, period, in the world. It was discovered in Germany, and it's called the Vogelherd horse, after the cave where it was discovered, and it has these exquisite lines to it, you know, beautifully arched neck and a head that is bent just right, and a curved back. And I wondered when I saw that whether that isn't one of the things, that aesthetic wasn't one of the things that attracted us to horses from the very beginning.
It's an actually absolutely beautiful piece, and obviously something that had been handled, and the person who carved that loved that animal.
Whoever it was, that was what was remarkable to me. You know, as you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about horses in art from that particular time period, which was maybe 12 to 35,000 years ago. And it fascinated me because not just for the beauty and the aesthetics of the art that they created, but for their knowledge of horse behavior. They truly understood horses as long ago as that. They must have spent a lot of time watching the horses.
And there's so much in your book, so many surprising things. And maybe before we get to that, talk about your book. You traveled around the world for this book and talked with many, many people.
Yes, you know, I have to explain. It's not a training book, and it's not a how-to book, and, you know, I'm certainly not an expert horse in horsemanship or an expert in horse care. What I did was visit with well over 100 scientists who work all around the world in the sciences that work in uncovering this horse-human partnership. So I went to Mongolia, went to France, Spain, Vienna, Edinburgh. Where else?
That's right. All over the place.
The Netherlands, and of course, many, many places in the United States. Sometimes I can't remember them all, but there's a great map in the beginning of the book that tells you where I went. So.
Well, it is wonderful, and that's what I think makes adds so much to the learning and the color in the book. It's really quite well done. Robert, we just lost a caller there. So you can join in again. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Here's something that I learned in your book early on. You're talking about horse behavior. Wild horse behavior was something that really fascinated me because, especially when it came to the stallions and their...
Oh, yeah.
And their, you know, all of Sky King and the old television shows I saw when I was a kid, the horse was always, the stallion was always the dominant and dominated and led the mares around, and that ain't the way it works.
No, that's not how it works at all. Most of the time, the mares just roll their eyes and say, please, would you go away? I got a real kick out of the time that I spent with Jason Ransom, the equine ethologist who studies behavior of horses in the wild, because I, too, thought of stallions, was taught to think of stallions as, you know, the mares would huddle and wait to be protected by the stallion, and of course that's not the case at all. Mostly what happens is the stallions run around the field causing problems and arguing with each other, and the mares keep on eating and taking care of their offspring. And, you know, it's not true that the stallion leads the mare places either. Often what happens is that the mares will decide to do something different or to go somewhere else, and the stallion will run around and follow up in the back and say, hey, wait for me. Don't forget about me.
It's not as though the stallion is pushing them anywhere. He's following.
He's following a lot of times. He's not really pushing. You know, I don't want to take away from the stallion's role. The stallion at times, when it's necessary, does protect mares from, you know, from whatever predators might be there. But I don't think there are too many predators that attack horses in the modern era. So his role is really more to just argue with the other stallions and see who is going to get to be the stallion that hangs out with the mares most.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. But the mares can choose. You had a really interesting in that chapter about a particular mare that just decided she was going to be with this one stallion regardless.
Oh, right, Hightail. You know, that was a wonderful story to me, maybe because I am 65 and Hightail was at the end of her life. But what was remarkable is that the scientist I was with, Jason Ransom, had data from her life that went back many, many years. So researchers can look and say, well, at a certain time in a certain place, she was with a certain stallion, and then she changed the stallion. Now, often they were watching the horses so closely that they knew why she changed and what she did. So when we saw her, which was probably 2 years ago, two summers ago now, she was with one particular stallion. She looked a little, as I say, it's clear that she was long in the tooth, as they say, and mm-hmm. had seen better days. But she was still herself, and she was still there with one of her offspring and the current stallion. But over the course of time, Hightail, as they called her, Hightail had had several different stallions. And she began her adult life with one particular stallion, and that stallion fell from grace. Another stallion came and tried to force her to stay with him, but although she wasn't as strong as that stallion, she was certainly persistent, and she was able to take off at every chance she got and go back to the stallion that she preferred being with until finally the second stallion just got fed up.
You know? Threw up his hooves and said, the heck with you.
You know, that's what we like to say, but he just stopped. He stopped trying to get her back, and she went and stayed with the first stallion.
Oh, man, great stories. Wendy Williams, our guest today, she is the author of The Horse, the Epic History of Our Noble Companion. Having a lot of fun talking with her today. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or post them on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'll be back with Wendy right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Throughout history, there have been iconic horses on screen and in real life. I think about Black Beauty or Seabiscuit, Hidalgo. And of course, that list goes on. And they've all been portrayed as creatures with roles in wars and on expeditions, so forth. And tell you what, there's a wonderful new book out called The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companion. I learned an awful lot reading this book, and very entertainingly written by Wendy Williams. Wendy is the author, journalist, whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Boston Globe, and elsewhere. She's also the author of several books, Lifelong Equestrian. And once again, thank you, Wendy, for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And there are so many questions answered in this book. And we have some callers online with questions for you. So I'd like to go to Zach in Milwaukee first.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Zach.
I am curious as to know when and where the domestication of the horse occurred. And if you guys have any idea, or if anthropologists have any idea, how this actually happened.
That's a really interesting question, Zach. And I spent a whole chapter thinking about that in the book because I, too, wanted to know, inquiring minds wanted to know. And the bottom line is we're not really sure. The current scientific facts that are established are that the earliest known and widely accepted evidence of horse domestication was from about 5,500 years ago in a place called Botai in Central Asia. And what scientists found there was out on a grassy plain, there was a village where they found post holes from the little huts that were there, and they also found post holes from what would be paddocks. Inside the paddocks, they found broken pottery shards, and when they looked at the broken pottery shards, they found that there were some residues from mare's milk. So it looks like people were keeping horses in those days and milking the mares and consuming the milk. which is still done today, by the way, there. We don't do it in this country, but in that country they still do that. But whether that represents the first or only the earliest known evidence is unclear. I went and spent quite a long time in a place called Galicia in northwestern Spain, where there are some horses. They're really pony-sized, but they're called horses, called garanos, who seem to have been there from time immemorial. But again, we can't trace how far back the garanos have been there. Scientists in Galicia, in Spain, think that these horses were there as far back as the time of the Ice Ages, but it can't be proven. So these people in Galicia suggest that they may have started domestication and riding. It's important to remember that domestication is not the same thing as riding. You could ride a horse without domesticating it. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be very good at it. But if you were a small horse, like the garanos are, they're really pony size, and they seem to be relatively mild-mannered. And if you were a large man riding a small horse, you could do it. It's possible. So did riding begin there, as the Galicians say, or did it begin in the area around Batay and then come east? No one knows for sure. My own speculation, and it's pure speculation, is that riding began much earlier than the domestication of horses at Batay. Hmm. It just seems natural to us.
Yeah. And Zach, thanks again for calling in. And, you know, as you talk about in the book, it's really possible to sit on a horse and ride a horse, but not on a cow or other animals, at least comfortably. And that has to do with the
I think it's comfortably. You can do it. I mean, I've ridden a camel, and I didn't ride the camel for too long because it was very disconcerting for me. It was so different from riding a horse. I thought, well, I've had enough of that. And I've ridden an elephant, you know, and that's a very different experience. And you can, you know, little boys ride water buffalo and mm-hmm. over in the east. So you can ride these other animals, but to really comfortably ride an animal and spend a day with it, the horses are obviously the best choice.
Yeah, they have a very, the spine is straight for one thing, I think.
Yes, the spine is straight. You can comfortably ride the horse. And as I say, you know, you really don't need either a saddle or a bridle. There are a lot of people these days who are experimenting with training horses to be ridden without using any tack at all. It's quite fascinating. I put a picture on my Facebook page the other day of a young girl, looked like she was 15 or so, jumping her pony bareback and with no bridle either or halter or anything over 3-foot fences.
Ah!
Yeah. Well, you know, the horse is predisposed to want to partner up with us. And if you can work with a horse and develop the horse's trust, you can ride that horse even as far as going over jumps without any tack at all.
Caroline in Milwaukee has a comment for us. Caroline, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and that was a great segue, what you just finished up with about earning the trust of a horse. I had probably the greatest experience of my life involved a horse. About 15 years ago, when I, too, was 20 years old, I received a scholarship to study in this tiny little Irish village in Western Ireland. And one of my first days of school, I had this mile-long walk through this idyllic bit of land to school. And on one of my first days, I was just walking, and I happened to notice this brown lump beyond a hill. Mm. And I kept getting closer and closer, and I looked, and it was this emaciated, half-dead horse.
Oh.
And it was awful. you can imagine coming upon that. And so I went, and I held her head, and didn't go to school that day, spent the entire day rowling anybody I could find in the town, making lots of friends. Long story short, I got the horse some care. I got her moved closer to the cottage I was living in, and I got to spend 16 months in this village.
Mm.
Over the next 16 months, she had rain rot all over her back. Over the next 16 months, the profound friendship I made with this horse is unbelievable.
Mm.
She... I got her to the point where I spent all of my money, all of my tuition money.
Well, you know, it was an education in a different way.
I was able to, at the end, she would allow me to climb up on her back and sit there and take anesthetic and work on her rain rot, which is like a, you know, the problem with her skin. Mm. I spent many a cold, rainy night in Ireland with blankets on her, sitting with an umbrella over her head. And it got to the point when she would stick her head in my window of my cottage and eat oats from my kitchen, and we became absolute pals. And it got to the point where when I would come and see her during the day after school, she would rear up right in front of me and keep doing it in a circle around me. Mm-hmm. I could sit on the ground, and she would lay on the ground and put her head on my lap, and we would sit there and just pet. And
boy, it must have been tough to leave.
I'm sorry?
It must have been tough to leave.
Well, that was my next thing. I was sad to leave school and the friends I made and the cottage and the experience I had, but I don't think I've ever wept so profoundly for another living thing than I did for, I named her Olive because that was the color of her skin, for when I left her. And it just, I knew nothing about horses. I had had animals in my life and knew that they had deep qualities and character, you know, beyond what we normally consider, or some people normally consider. But I've just never experienced it so profoundly than I did with a horse.
Oh.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the remarkable things about the relationship between horses and humans, and one reason why it works, because horses, dogs, my border collie is here right now watching me talk on the phone. Hey, I thought we were going out. And people are all beings who live together in small, tightly bonded groups. And as we know from dogs, we don't think twice about the fact that dogs and humans bond. We know that. But people haven't thought too much before about the fact that horses and humans can bond, too. Of course, we all know from the Budweiser commercials, dogs and horses can bond. But we're all three beings that live through bonding with other beings, and there's no reason why it should be restricted to bonding within our own species.
Yeah.
So that's a wonderful story you told me. It's a story that a lot of people are, these days, they're considering the fact that horses can bond and that you can have a better relationship with a horse if you bond with them. One of the things about training horses these days is people are talking more and more about the importance of working with the horse on the ground for a long time, well before you ever climb up on the horse's back.
Yeah. It's Caroline, thank you so much for telling that story.
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Well, that must have been very hard. You have a chapter on communication. When she talked about rearing, I immediately thought of
Karen and Lucas. Yes,
Karen and Lucas, because there's a nice photo of Lucas kind of rearing up for Karen, and you spend quite a bit of time in that chapter just talking about the relationship that. The relationship
that can develop.
Yes.
And I like that story a lot because Karen is a retired psychiatric nurse.
Yeah.
So she had learned certain techniques in dealing with complex individuals. And when I spent time with her, I saw her apply some of those techniques to Lucas. She used a lot of shaping technique with Lucas. She never said no. She just moved Lucas's feet to where she wanted them to be so that he didn't feel like he was being chastised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was not an oppositional relationship there. He was just placed in a position that would be better for him and better for Karen. Lucas was a retired racehorse. He had bowed tendons and was taken off the racing circuit quite young at the age of 2. And then he had a difficult life for the next 3 or 4 years because he was temperamental and prone to fits of unhappiness, which endangered other horses and people. And no one knew quite what to do with him. So they threw him out in a paddock and left him there, which is kind of typical for horses
with
that temperament. And through the grapevine, Karen learned about him and got hold of him. And she tried also to ride him, but decided quickly that riding was probably not going to be a very good way to communicate with Lucas. I did ask her one time when I was there visiting her, I said, do you ever ride Lucas? And she said, oh, he doesn't care for that at all. So,
but they have this wonderful relationship.
Yeah, they had an absolutely wonderful relationship. She spends 3 or 4 hours a day at the barn, and it's not about riding at all. It's just about interacting with each other. So she's very interested in the knowledge base that horses have and their ability to learn. So she has lots and lots of little things to do, like she'll lay out on his hay bale green squares and red triangles and ask Lucas to pick the right one, and he usually does. And she does all other kinds of things like that. Then we spent some time while she was with him in the paddock. What I enjoyed most, I enjoyed the whole time there, really, but what I enjoyed most was the fact that Karen and I, being two old ladies, got to talking about stuff, horses, no doubt. And at some point, Lucas got very bored, just like a little kid gets bored. And he started doing all kinds of things that would get Karen's attention. You know, he pawed the ground, and he bowed his head, and he swayed from side to side, and he did all kinds of things, and nothing worked. Karen just kept talking. So eventually he walked over, and he picked her, he picked up the jacket of her arm. He picked her arm up very gently by the sleeve, very gently, and just led her away. That is enough of that. I'm tired of you talking to her. You're here for me. So, you know, his bonding is a jealous sort of bonding, I think, but he doesn't want anybody to spend too much time with her. He prefers to be with her himself.
You know, when you mentioned the having him pick various shapes and such, reminded me again of a story that many listeners may have read about at one point or another from years back, and that's Clever Hans, that particular horse. You have a story of the story of Clever Hans in the book, which really. He was supposedly could add and subtract and multiply, and it turned out that was not the case. But he's still a very clever horse.
Clever Hans was a really interesting story to me because Clever Hans, well, but I should tell people quickly what the story is. The person who owned Clever Hans would do math problems, and Clever Hans would always get them right, even if they were very difficult division problems or multiplication problems. When he was asked for the answer, he would tap his foot to get to the right number, and he was always correct. So people were amazed by this, but they decided that somehow or other it was because Clever Hans was reading something into the owner's body language. So they put Clever Hans to the test by having people that the horse did not know ask questions. And even then, Clever Hans answered those questions correctly. So finally, people said, well, it can't be true that a horse can do long division. So they put Clever Hans behind a screen and had strangers ask the question. And once Clever Hans was behind the screen, he couldn't answer the question correctly any longer. So they realized it had something to do with Clever Hans being able to actually read the body language of humans to find out when they get to the right answer. Who knows? Maybe it was the subtle movement of the eyebrows. Maybe it was a subtle smile. It could be anything. But horses watch us so closely that he could have read that signal in many, many different ways. What I thought was interesting was once they figured that out, they dismissed Clever Hans as not a very smart horse. But to my mind, that shows how very smart he was, because he was able to read our body language much better than most of us can read a horse's body language.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Do you have, there was a mention of horse racing, and Matt wondered if you have an opinion on American horse racing, is it ethical?
You know, people do ask me questions like that, and one thing I decided to do with this book was to try to write about science and not write about the ethical aspects of any one particular practice with horses. I think my goal is that people should have this basic information about horses, and then they should decide for themselves whether American horse racing is ethical or trotting racing is ethical, because it's really not for me to tell other people how to make their own ethical decisions about life. I think that comes from me being 65. I grew up at a time in this country where people provided information and let people make the decisions for themselves. You know, I have my own private thoughts about a lot of things that go on in the world of horses, and I just decided to keep that out of this book. This is just a basic informational book, and then maybe people will take that information and apply it to the worlds they live in and give what they do with horses a second look.
There's so many things that we haven't gotten into in your book. I was so intrigued by the adaptability of horses and their ability to, you know, change as conditions change over long periods of time.
You know, that's really amazing to me, and I was interested in hearing your caller's discussion of rain rot, because one thing that is hard for most horses is being in a climate that's very rainy. Their hide doesn't do well. They do develop issues with their skin. But as we speak, I'm looking at the computer. My husband has arranged all the different photos from our trips on the computer, so I can see them pass by. And I'm looking at the computer at a picture of one of the guaranos that lives in this North Atlantic climate where it's rainy all the time and very cold. And that horse is just doing just fine. So, you know, they can adapt to a lot of different circumstances in life, a lot of different habitats. One habitat they apparently couldn't adapt to was the quick climate change that came at the end of the ice ages when the North American continent got warmer. That they did not do well with, and about 10,000 years or so they became extinct in North America after they'd evolved here for 56 million years.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. I think it's quite amazing. But, you know, I think that there were so many changes that happened on our continent so quickly that they just couldn't keep up.
Yeah. Well, the adaptability to grass, as we were talking about, you were writing about grass. Of course, grass is so important to the lives of horses. When you talked about the lava... that was sort of landed like little shards of glass on the...
Yes. That's near you, too. I just think that was such an amazing sight. Everybody should go and see that. It's in northeastern Nebraska, and it's called Ashfall. About 20 million years ago or so, conditions were absolutely fantastic for horses in the North American continent. And there were many, many, many different species of horses on this continent. And some of them had three toes, and some of them had one toe, and some of them were big, and some of them were small. And some of them had the particular kind of teeth that allowed them to eat leaves, and some of them had a particular kind of teeth that allowed them to eat grass. So there was an awful lot of variety, and we know a great deal about those horses because of this site that I was talking about in northeastern Nebraska called Ashfall. Mm-hmm. There was a pond there where a lot of animals lived. It was like the Serengeti, not just horses, but all kinds of other things.
You know what? We are out of time.
That's too bad.
That's too bad, because I really wanted to hear that. Said, well, people are just going to have to get your book and read it. One quick comment from Robert.
My teacher used to say to me, if you want to know what happens, you have to read the book, children.
And Robert says in a comment, the horse can run like a deer, see like a hawk, smell like a bloodhound, hear like an owl, and can be trained to march with a man into certain death and like it. What's not to love?
That's a nice sentence.
Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Wendy Williams is the author of The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companion. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll find links right there to Wendy and her site and her book. And, I'm so sorry we're out of time. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.